Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. If you're hiring, with Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/NPR podcast.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It is Ethan Hawke's moment, a critically acclaimed turn as a writer and director in the country music biopic Blaze, and then there was his performance in First Reformed, already drawing Oscar buzz.
Can God forgive us for what we've done to this world?
Who can know the mind of God? But we can choose a righteous life. Belief, forgiveness, grace covers us all. I believe that.
Well, Dead Poets Society made Ethan Hawke a star. Reality Bites made him a Gen X icon. But then an unconventional career turn. He wrote novels, screenplays, became director Richard Linklater's artistic muse. Oscar nominations sprinkled throughout, but for some reason, praise from critics always seemed a little reluctant, even when it was richly deserved. This hour on Point, Ethan Hawke and what might be his biggest year yet. And Ethan Hawke joins us now from Santa Monica, California. Welcome to On Point, Ethan.
Thanks for having me. It was quite a nice introduction.
I can't take any credit for it. We've got a great staff here who does some phenomenal writing for me. You know how it is, like working with great writers and directors?
It makes it easy.
It does make it easy. Well, I want to spend quite a bit of time talking about the new movie Blaze here. And I just want to give people a little taste for the sound of the film, at least. It is a country music biopic directed by you. First-time actor Ben Dickey stars as Blaze Foley, and veteran Aaliyah Shawkat portrays his partner, Sybil Rosen. So here's a scene.
So you're going to be a big country star, like Roger Miller?
Huh?
I don't want to be a star. I want to be a legend.
Well, what's the difference, Debbie?
Well, stars burn out because they shine for themselves. Look at me shine. Look at me glow. I'm amazing. Legend lasts forever.
This is a scene from the new movie Blaze. Ethan Hawke, when did you first hear of Blaze Foley?
Well, that's an interesting question. Funnily enough, my knowledge of Blaze Foley is totally integrated with my friendship with Ben Dickey, who plays Blaze in the movie. Our respective partners, Beth and Ryan, were best friends from the second grade. So when I was falling in love with Ryan, I had to pass through the Beth and Ben test. You know, I had to have dinner with Beth and Ben and get approval. And so I met Ben about, 13 years ago. And we just became fast friends. He's from Arkansas. I'm from Texas. We love talking about music and sports and art and jokes and Steve Martin and all things that interested us. And I fell in love with his music. And I started watching his band. He had this band, the Blood Feathers, in Philly, and they were amazing. And I believed in them and would go see their shows. And I was just really moved by Ben's relationship to music. And I always thought that he should be an actor. I was always trying to talk him into being in one of my plays or something, but he just would have none of it. And finally, one night, New Year's Eve of 2015, his band had just finally broken up and they'd been beaten up by the music industry and spit out, and it was over. And he was pretty close to despondent about it. Mm. And I said to him that night, remember Blaze Foley. Because he had taught me about Blaze 5-8 years earlier. We had this, John Prine had released Clay Pigeons was one of Blaze's songs. And I had said to Ben, that's my favorite John Prine song ever. And he said, no, that's a Blaze Foley song. And we're like, oh, Blaze, that's Lucinda Williams wrote Drunken Angel about Blaze Foley. Willie Nelson and Merle Haggard covered If I Could Only Fly. And we're like, who is this weird Blaze Foley? Rumors were he was best friends with Townes Van Zandt. And we just used to geek out about him. And slowly over the years, we discovered, you know, when the internet started happening, you could find more of Blaze's music. And we would share his music. And so when Ben was blue that night, I was like, well, remember Blaze? There's so many artists in the world who are singing beautiful songs, who are contributing, that don't find a way in the commercial marketplace. And that's the fault of the marketplace, not You know, I really wanted him to keep believing in himself. And he picked up my guitar and he started playing Clay Pigeons and imitating Blaze. And I said, goofily out loud, you should play Blaze Foley in a movie. And the idea just kind of charged me. And I started pursuing it. And that's how I ended up finding Sybil Rosen's book and started writing this movie for Ben. Huh. That was a long answer to a very short question.
But a good answer and an interesting one. I mean, because you mentioned in there that Blaze Foley's music had been covered by like some really big names in country music. And yet, I mean, look, we've got a native Texan on our staff here. He's the one who's producing this hour, Brian. And he told me, he's like, he'd never even heard of Blaze Foley.
Most people haven't. I mean, that's what makes it one of the things that I loved about this idea. I had made this documentary called Seymour an Introduction, which is about an 88-year-old piano maestro. And that was a very exciting process for me. And one of the things that it illuminated for me is how so much music and movies are two great tastes that go great together. And I thought I could use Blaze's life to do a portrait that is more accurately speaks to the experience of a life dedicated to the arts, mm-hmm. you know, which is not the trials of celebrity, which is what most biopics turn into being about.
Right.
Which is, frankly, pretty boring.
Well, I want to play another clip from the movie here because Blaze Foley had other trials in his life, which you put on screen. I mean, it focuses the movie. It's this meditation on, you know, there's this certain self-destructive nature of, you know, Klieg-lite celebrity, but then there's the self-destructive challenges that many, many other people have. So in this scene from Blaze, we hear a little bit about that and his final performance at an Austin club called The Outhouse.
You feel like you're not going to be alive much longer?
Yeah, with the way you live, that's not much of a premonition. That's wishful thinking.
So Ethan Hawke, I mean, what were Blaze Foley's demons, his self-destructive nature?
Depression, number one. You know, I mean, I think as I studied him and studied his relationship to creativity, and it reminded me of so many of my friends and who struggle with depression, just flat out, whatever you want to call it, the black cat blues. You know, I mean, it's hard to wrangle. But I think in truth, he had an allergy to the necessary phoniness required to sell yourself. I mean, even me on this show, right? I have to kind of put on this voice like I'm somebody worth listening to and that I, you know, made a good film and that you should pay attention. There's something a little phony about it,
yeah.
Right? Whenever you're out there selling yourself. And it's like Tolstoy had a great line. He said his brother was definitely the great artist of the family. He just lacked the necessary negative attributes to excel. Mm-hmm. And Blaze had opportunities in his life to have recording deals and people approached him, and he usually torpedoed his own fleet, mostly due to an anger that he had for the people who had the money to make the money and the power to make his dreams come true. And I've seen that from so many artists that when met with someone who can make their dreams come true, their reaction is to punch them in the face. It doesn't make sense. And you can call it authenticity or you can call it self-sabotage, but why people sabotage themselves, I really don't know. And it's very interesting to me.
So let's talk a little more about what you said a second ago about Blaze Foley's allergy to phoniness. Because you're right, like even though every day that I do this job, I try to put my real authentic self out there, there is an aspect of performance because, you know, you have to make it something that people want to listen to. But you are in a field, you've had a career, you have a career that on the one hand is one of artistic expression, but on the other hand, a lot of phoniness. I mean, do you have that same allergy to phoniness, or is it just something you've learned to live with?
God, you know, what an interesting question. There is a joy that comes from doing work that you're proud of. You know, like, let's say we worked on Boyhood for 12 years, right? Mm-hmm. This movie I made with Richard Linklater, and we made it with these kids and watched them grow up, and it was the definition of authentic. It felt like watercoloring alone in your room with some friends or something, or playing music at Christmas Eve or something. It was, we were never selling. Imagine that, for more than a decade making something, you never had to sell it. And it was very beautiful. But I loved selling the movie too. And maybe I'm too much of a ham. Maybe you could say I'm a phony. I enjoyed every aspect of sharing that movie. I loved being at a mall in New Jersey and seeing people go, wait, you made that movie? I understand. I have friends of mine, directors, people who get so angry that the world is full of phoniness. I just expect it to be phony. I have a different attitude about it. Anytime there's a crack in the armor and you see somebody go, hey, I'm here, you feel it like, you know, when a great Nina Simone performance, when you feel her heart break on stage and it's not phony. I'm grateful for that. I mean, I know most of life is game show hosts, right? I get it. And I think what I love about Blaze's music is his music itself, when you touch it, it's messy and sloppy and real. I remember being a little kid, and my mother had this album, Nashville Skyline, right? It's a Bob Dylan record. And I listened to the first track. It's Girl from the North Country, and it's Dylan singing with Johnny Cash, and it's a mess. They like don't know the words, and their harmonies are off, and the one of them starts the wrong verse. And it's so wonderful. Because you feel like it's your uncle and your best friend sitting on a porch just singing from their heart. And I remember I just loved listening to it. And it's the way I approached this movie, because I tried to harness that energy of front porch music, roots music, whatever that is, writing from your heart. And I do think Blaze wrote from his heart, and it made it hard for him to want to pimp it.
Yeah.
You know? It's easier for the Beatles to pimp it because there's something pimping going on about all that. You know, they're selling the whole time and they're good enough to be true. You know, I find life fascinating that way. Emily Dickinson is true blue and she never sold a poem, you know, and Bob Dylan is true blue and he's sold 10 million poems, you know. There's no right or wrong. I just think, I don't know what I'm saying. It's just interesting to me.
Well, we're talking with Ethan Hawke. He's the writer, director, and producer of the new film Blaze. It's a biopic about country musician Blaze Foley. We've got a link to the film's trailer at our website, onpointradio.org. There's a lot more to talk with Ethan Hawke when we come back, so we'll do that in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Right till the sun comes up and down around me about two or three times. Smoking cigarettes in the last seat. Try myself and the people I meet and get along with it all. Go down what people say, oh, feed the pigeons some clay. Turn a night into day. Start talking again when I know what to say.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel Alarcón, host of NPR's Spanish language podcast, Radio Ambulante. We tell engaging, one-of-a-kind stories that give you a more nuanced sense of Latin America and the U.S. Latino community today. From events that are changing the political landscape to intimate stories about everyday people. Listen to Radio Ambulante on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Ethan Hawke. He's obviously a writer, actor, and director. Hawke's latest film, which he directs, is called Blaze. It's a biopic of country musician Blaze Foley. Here's a bit of Foley's own music. This is If I Could Only Fly, recorded in 1989.
Almost felt you touching me just now. Wish I knew which way to turn and go. Feel so good, then I feel so bad. Wonder what I ought to do.
Now, Ethan, before the break, you were talking about Boyhood, the terrific 2014 film that you're in. That, yes, it took 12 years, right, to make with Richard Linklater. And I just want to play a scene from it. You play Mason Evans, and in this scene, you take your kids out for a day out in Houston, and you're really sort of lamenting about the monosyllabic responses that you get from, or that Mason gets from his son and daughter.
All right. No, 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 no. No, that is not how we are going to talk to one another, all right? No, I will not be that guy. You cannot put me in that category, all right? The biological father I spend every other week with and I make polite conversation, you know, while he drives me places and buys me. No. Talk to me. Samantha, how was your week? I don't know, Dad, it was kind of tough. Billy and Ellen broke up, and Ellen's kind of mad at me because she saw me talking to Billy in the cafeteria. And you remember that sculpture I was working on? Well, it was a unicorn, and the horn broke off, so now it's a zebra, okay? But I still think I'm going to get an A, right? Mason, how was your week? Well, Dad, you know, it's kind of tough. Joey's kind of a jerk. Actually, he stole some cigarettes from his mom. He wanted me to smoke them, but I said no because I knew what a hard time you had quitting smoking, Dad. How about that? Is that so hard?
That's Ethan Hawke in Boyhood. You know, I know that when this film first came out, you probably talked a lot about this, but I just want to ask you again, because what kind of treat isn't even the right word. Like, gift was it to be part of a film that you had, you know, years to work on it rather than, you know, as an actor, maybe, I don't know, do you drop into a movie set usually for a couple of weeks and then it's all done? I mean, it was the whole thing was done on such a different time scale. It must have been kind of incredible for you.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's using time as clay. It's,
yeah.
You know, the whole, but we did, Rick and I did the Before trilogy together too, Before mm-hmm. Sunrise, Before Sunset, Before Midnight. And in a way, all four of these films are, time is the main character.
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting thing. And, you know, for Boyhood particularly, I was also being asked to do a portrait of fatherhood that was really interesting to me. I'm a child of divorce, and I've parented from the position of a divorced father, too. And so it's kind of a lion in my psyche and something that I think a lot about and had a lot to say about. And it was really fun to put that somewhere. To have this weird project where I could use pieces of my own life, my own parenting, my own childhood, my own father. You know, Rick and I are both from Texas. Both our fathers are in the insurance business. We have a lot in common. So when he approached me to do this, it's unlike any job I've ever, can you imagine, like, you know, hey, you want to make a movie for a week a year for the next 12 years? It's a very bizarre ask, but it was very exciting because I felt like the first actor ever to be asked to do something like this.
Yeah.
You know, it was really, really unique.
Well, I want to ask you in a minute more about sort of your collaborations with Richard Linklater, but the thing about Boyhood and the Before series as well, that from our perspective as viewers of these movies is, for people who've been in front of a camera for a long period of time, from the time they were young, we all get to watch you grow up in the different films that you're in over time. But here are two examples where, you know, we were really watching you grow up almost in real time because you're also inhabiting the same character. Then the character itself, you know, himself is growing up. So for me as a viewer, it was kind of it's kind of amazing. It's like watching Ethan Hawke grow up on the screen in front of my eyes in 90 minutes.
It's strange for me. Imagine I am Ethan Hawke, so that is weird. And I think that one of the things that's interesting, it's why so many of us go nuts, but, you know, actors are forced to have a relationship to time and aging that is different than most people. You're forced to look at it all the time. You're constantly aware of how society sees you. You know, every project I go in on, you know, you go into some trailer and the hair and makeup person says, are we okay with the gray? You know, and you have to make this decision of like, are you okay with it? Do you want to enhance it? Do you want to, I mean, it's, you have to have a sense of humor about it. You know, I love it. And I think that because of these things that you're talking about, maybe it's helped me. I enjoy this whole process, but I do know that it has its difficulties.
Yeah. Well, so in the very beginning of this hour, when I introduced you, I said that, you know, it seems as if you're having a moment right now. Does it feel like that to you, that this point in your career is something special?
It's such a, I don't, awareness of how other people see you is such a dangerous thing to even let yourself think about. I've been putting one foot in front of the other for basically 30 years. You know, we were filming Dead Poets Society about 30 years ago today, and I've just been trying to keep my head up. Does it feel, I've felt it, you know, when Reality Bites came out, you feel the zeitgeist mm-hmm. moving towards you. You know, even when I was 18 and Dead Poets Society, you feel it. There's some weird psychic pull. You know, when Training Day came out, you feel it. When Boyhood came out, you feel it. And there is an accumulation factor, it seems. My wife really notices it. You know, I've made a lot of movies now, and different ones are different people's favorites.
Yeah.
You know, if I make a, there's certain people that love horror films, and that's all they want to talk to me about is Sinister or The Purge, right? Or there's people that see the Before trilogy, and Criterion Collection is everything that matters. There's a lot of people that don't know I've ever done anything besides Training Day. You know, there's still certain people that want to talk to me about Gattaca all night long. I've accumulated a lot of work, so it does feel like an interesting moment for me because I've been studying this thing since I was a kid. I took some of my Dead Poets Society money and made a short film. And this is the first time I really made a movie that audiences really connect with. And that feels, to be totally corny with you, amazing. And the funny thing about First Reformed is this is the best character I've ever been on the page. The character was electric, mm-hmm. and the time we're in right now is a very scary time, and Paul Schrader is a grown-up. He's writing a grown-up movie, and it has a cry attached to it of where is leadership? Where is our spiritual leadership? Where is our political leadership? And what is happening with my generation, and what are we doing? And it's very angry. And I think people are relating to seeing a movie that's not geared to a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
We have so much of even what passes for really good movies is still oriented and sold to 15 to 18-year-olds. And look, I have a 16-year-old and a 20-year-old. I love them and I want movies to be directed to them. But I think there's something nice about seeing adult art. So I think that Paul's film, First Reformed, is speaking to our climate right now in a way that is really exciting. And for me, I had this amazing year, regardless of what anybody thinks about it. I got to direct Charlie Sexton and Ben Dickey in a kind of wild idea of casting musicians as musicians. You keep calling it a biopic, you know, and I hate that expression. I know it's true that it is one, but for me,
you should have told me that earlier.
No, I don't mind you calling it, but Blaze, because he's not famous, in a way, it really is the anti-biopic, because what the point of the movie is about how many Blaze Foleys are out there, right? And I got to take two musicians and really do a portrait of creativity and of love and where they intersect and where the self-sabotage intersects with that. But where I'm going with this is, in helping these two guys, these men that I really admire, use their art and focus it on acting in a way that they weren't 100% comfortable with because they weren't that experienced with, focused me as an actor. And the next thing I did was First Reformed, and I got to throw myself at it with a kind of velocity that I hadn't thrown myself at a part in a long mm-hmm. time. And luckily for me, the writing was there to hold it.
Well, if I can, I want to actually play a scene from First Reformed. You play Reverend Ernst Toller, and a minister struggling mightily with faith and morality. And this is a scene particularly, I think, that speaks to what you were just talking about, Ethan, about sort of how a lot of people are feeling in this moment. So, again, here's Ethan Hawke in First Reformed.
Courage is the solution to despair. Reason provides no answers. We can't know what the future will bring. We have to choose despite uncertainty. Wisdom is holding two contradictory truths in our mind simultaneously. Hope and despair. A life without despair is a life without hope. Holding these two ideas in our head is life itself.
Ethan Hawke, tell me a little bit more about this film, because I really was interested in hearing you say that you have been in a bunch of films that, for whatever reason, when they come out, capture something about how many, many people are feeling in that moment. How does this film do it in particular?
Well, I mean, that's the job of art, right?
Yeah.
I mean, is to take some kind of collective thought and present a conversation, to transfuse it into dance or a poem or a play or a picture, and allow us as a community to have a dialogue. And a healthy community is like a healthy person, right? It has a healthy mind. And this movie, even listening to that clip, I so admire Paul. You know, I mean, you can hear in my character's situation, he's in so much pain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and to get to do a portrait of a person who's dedicated their life to their inner life, to their religious calling, and not to mock them, and not to make it about superstition. It's a sincere person who is trying to pursue their faith despite personal tragedy. My character's lost his son in the movie, and I'm counseling a young man who is struggling. And it's a little life and death for my character because I don't think he can handle losing another young person, you know? Mm-hmm. I think he feels that way, and it's terrifying to him. And he's also this young person, and anybody who's got young people in their life knows young people can ask some brutally truthful questions that hurt about what we're doing and enlightening our hypocrisy. That's one of the things that's hard about raising teenagers. Teenagers are great for revealing your own hypocrisy to you. You know, we all have blind spots in our life, you know? And I can sit here on the radio and pontificate what I think about art, and you can believe me, my 16-year-old, my 20-year-old will let me know exactly what's phony about what I'm saying, you know? And God love them for it, right? But I guess to your question about what First Reformed is speaking to, I find issues of faith are very scary for us to talk about publicly. And faith is designed, you know, whatever you're, you know, whether you're Buddhist or Hindu or Methodist, it's very hard to talk about our inner seeking. And what I love about movies is they're this empathy generator, and they give us permission to ask those questions without being didactic or making us sign up for something. I love it. It's like going to church with, you know, but you get rock and roll and you get, you know, sexy photography.
So you mentioned Paul a couple of times, Paul Schrader, right? Who wrote this film. I mean, he's obviously written some, like, iconic movies. Taxi Driver,
Rager Bowl, American Gigolo.
Yeah, you know. Last Temptation mm-hmm. of Christ, too. I mean, had you, I can't remember if you had worked with him before.
I'd never worked with him. Okay. I never have. But I remember when I first moved to New York and I was studying acting, and I went to a double feature of Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. And I remember thinking, who the hell is Paul Schrader? And I remember Richard Linklater giving me his book, Transcendental Style and Film. He gave me Bresson's book, Notes on a Cinematographer, and Paul's book, because, you know, Rick really helped elevate my education about movies that have been essential to my growing up, my life.
Well, it's interesting because you have such a good, and I mean, such a long relationship with Richard Linklater, but this was the first film you'd worked on with Paul Schrader. So, I mean, what was that like?
What was it like? Well, working with Paul is fascinating because, you know, he's in his 70s, and he isn't cavalier with time anymore. He came to the set ferocious. I mean, he would forget to say good morning. He would forget to say goodbye. He was there to work. It was really like being with a master stonemason or something who felt like, you know, I got 6 weeks to carve this rock into St. Joan or whatever it is. You know, I mean, he just worked and worked. And unlike one of the things that happens as you get older, and I'm sure in whatever profession you're in, you start working with a lot of people who are younger than you, and that changes your dynamic in the workplace, you know? And because it used to be when I started, I looked up to everybody as a mentor, right? When I was on Dead Poets Society, everybody was older than me.
Yeah.
And it was really nice to be on a set with a guy who's a lot more experienced than I am and a lot more educated. And he is an opinionated person, and you have to fight for your beliefs if you want to impact him and and protect your art or facilitate his art or help him. And I loved it, mostly because of the quality of the writing. Mm-hmm. You know, when you work with Linkletter, it's different. It's more like jazz, you know? I mean, he's inviting you in to participate with him. It's a very beautiful experience. But with Paul, I mean, there's a meticulousness that has gone into the construction of the script and a creativity that you are joining. You know, it's and for me, what's great is I've had all these experiences, whether it's Alfonso Cuarón or Sidney Lumet or Peter Weir or Joe Dante or Scott Derrickson, all these people that I've worked with who've taught me. Then what's fun is then I get to take that to a film set and I get to pilfer from these, because the fun thing about making 50 movies is you realize that there's no right way to make a movie.
Yeah.
There's no wrong way. There's so many different ways. It's like the right way to make a rock and roll song. There isn't one. There is wrong intent. If your intent is to sneak your hand behind somebody's back and pull money out of their pocket without them seeing, you're going to make a bad movie or a movie that I won't like. And if your intent is to communicate, you know, then something good's probably going to happen.
Well, we're talking with Ethan Hawke this hour. His latest movie, which he wrote, directed, and produced, is called Blaze, and it's the story of country musician Blaze Foley. We're going to talk a lot more about Hawke's movie career when we come back. So, Ethan, if you could just stand by for a minute here. We're going to go out of this segment with music from Hawke's 2017 movie, First Reformed. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal. For 20 years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been making fun of the news with comedians and celebrity guests. We got silly limericks. We got terrible impressions. If you think the news is a joke, wait till you hear our show. New podcast episodes are available every Saturday.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking today with Ethan Hawke. He's obviously an actor, writer, and director known for many films, everything from the Before series to Dead Poets Society to Reality Bites. His latest film, which he wrote, directed, and produced, is called Blaze, and it's the story of country musician Blaze Foley. We've got the film's whole trailer at our website, onpointradio.org. And Ethan Hawke, if I could, I just want to play two scenes from two of your films. First of all, we got to play a scene from Dead Poets Society. And here is you as one of the students being taught by an inspirational English teacher played by now the late Robin Williams.
Close your eyes. Close them. Now, describe what you see.
I close my eyes.
Yes.
And this image floats beside me.
Sweaty-toothed madman.
The sweaty-toothed madman with a stare that pounds my brain.
Oh, that's excellent. Now give him action. Make him do something.
His hands reach out and choke me.
That's wonderful, wonderful.
And all the time he's mumbling.
What's he mumbling?
Mumbling truth. Yeah, yeah. Truth like a blanket that always leaves your feet cold.
Forget them. Stay with the blanket. Tell me about that blanket.
You push it, stretch it, it'll never be enough. You kick at it, beat it, it'll never cover any of us. From the moment we enter crying to the moment we leave dying, it'll just cover your face as you wail and cry and scream.
Don't you forget this.
1989, Dead Poets Society. That's Ethan Hawke with Robin Williams there. You know, the power of that film is so great, Ethan, that even just hearing that scene again, visually, in my mind, I could see the motion of the camera around the classroom.
Me too.
It's amazing. So let's just jump forward a little bit here to a completely different kind of movie, but one that you also starred in with another tremendous actor. This is Training Day from 2001, and you were nominated for the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor in this movie. You play a rookie cop in a tough LAPD narcotics unit. And you play in this movie alongside Denzel Washington. So here's a scene.
A good narcotics agent should have narcotics in his blood.
What are you going to smoke that?
Nope, you are.
Hell if I am.
Yeah, you not?
No.
Why, you're a Mormon or something? You're Jesus freak?
No, man, I'm not losing my job.
This is your job.
I can't do that.
Smoke it.
Huh.
This ain't a test. Just take a hit.
Man, listen, I became a cop to stop people.
Yeah, blah, 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 blah. It's not a review board and it ain't cocaine. Take it here.
No, man.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, right. If I was a dealer, you'd be dead by now. You turn down on the street and the chief brings your wife a crisply folded flag. What's wrong with you?
It's Denzel Washington and Ethan Hawke in Training Day in 2001. The reason why I wanted to play those two of the many films is you've made so many different kinds of films over your three-decade career now. I mean, what's the movie that you haven't made yet that you want to?
Okay, that's a good question because, you know, I'm on an interview show. I'm allowed to say this. Kind of, I have a secret goal, right? And my goal is for my obituary to say that he made one great film in every genre. You know, that's really, I've never saw myself as such a fantastic actor that I can just like, you know, like Daniel Day-Lewis or something, just be great or all the time. I have to just do my best, but I can push myself to be in different genres of film, and that helps me be a different kind of actor. And so, you know, Training Day is a great cop picture, and, you know, Dead Poets Society is, I don't know exactly what genre, you know, the educational genre, or I don't know what you call that genre. I made White Fang, kids movie, you know, I've done a good horror film, I've done a couple good westerns. The one I really want to do just crazy comedy. I mean, that's where every time I watch like Talladega Nights or Step Brothers or something like that, I'm like, why won't they cast me? Can't I play like, there's got to be some part for me in one of these movies. When I was younger and first going into acting, you know, I really loved Warren Beatty, to be honest with you. And I thought Warren Beatty was so funny in Shampoo and Heaven Can Wait. And I even think in his dramas, what makes him so amazing in Reds or Bonnie and Clyde is his wit.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the secret ingredients when people say that I haven't done comedy is always like, the thing about the Before trilogies is you don't think of them as comedies, but they're so subtle and strange that, you know, they're really fun. Jesse and Celine are funny, but I'd really like to do like a movie like Stripes or Caddyshack or Groundhog Day or, you know, just a movie. I did this movie with Linkletter years ago called Tape that most people haven't seen, but it's a pretty funny movie, actually. But it's not a comedy. It's still, I really want to be in a crazy comedy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thought you were going to go in a different direction with this because I think I've read you say beforehand that, you know, you wanted to do like the Alec Guinness in Star Wars or Ian McKellen in Lord of the Rings.
Definitely. When you watch, you know, see, here's what I love about Alec Guinness in Star Wars or Ian McKellen as Gandalf or Patrick Stewart in, you know, X-Men or whatever. Like, these guys have lived a life studying acting. You can see it. And so they can take some of these corny lines and they just, you know, imbue them with such meaning. And I love it. They help these movies, you know, fly, you fools. I mean, that's a hard line. You know, your average actor can't pull off, you know, fly. And so Ian McKellen can, and it's a life well spent that has allowed him to do that. And so my hope is as the hair goes completely gray, that maybe I can get one of these villain parts or Jedi master. Or I don't know. I'll something. There's got to be some good parts. There's so much left to do.
So much left to do. Well, so, you know, we told folks on social media that we'd be talking to you, and they sent us, listeners sent us some questions. So Ali Reza Edraki says, is there going to be another sequel in the Before series, hoping for 2022, which would be when the next one would come out, right?
Yeah, the funny thing is that This is the lowest grossing trilogy of all time in cinema history. Nobody ever, you know, but before Sunset and Before Midnight, I remember friends going, you guys are making another one of those? Weren't they bombs? And now it's funny. Now everybody is asking us to make another one. And it's really scary because working with Rick and Julie and Jesse and Celine, they're really a part of, you know, the fabric of me. I love them. And I wouldn't want to do one for the sake of being together or doing what I'm really proud of them, you know?
I know why people are asking, if I could just jump in here. I think I know why people are asking you to make another one. Because, you know, we were talking before about watching you grow up on screen. Like with the Before series, for people who were about the same age when the first one came out, like with every 9 years, it's kind of like a touchstone of checking in where like, okay, well, here's where I am in my life. Where are they? I think that's a really strong connection.
There's something interesting about it. If we did it, Jesse and Celine would also be turning 50,
yeah,
which is an interesting age because it's an age that people don't dramatize a lot. You know, it's an interesting time that would be very fun to write about because you're not old and you're not young. And their kids probably will be grown up. It could be an interesting moment. Knowing Linkletter and Julie, whatever it is, I would be surprised if we don't visit them again. Whether or not we do it in a way that comes on time and on schedule, I don't know about that.
Yeah. Well, Ethan Hawke, if I may, I just kind of want to switch gears entirely here for just a couple of minutes because Hollywood itself has been under a lot of scrutiny recently. And you have spent so many decades in the movie business. So I just want to ask you a couple of questions about the business of making movies and me too, if I could.
Go there.
Because first of all, I mean, you were just a kid when you first started making these movies. I'm just curious, did you ever see any of the kind of behavior that now is, you know, being talked about a lot?
I don't think. I mean, I'd be curious what you think, but I don't know that in any industry that you can make it to 47 and not witness men abuse their position with women at some point. I don't know that I've been close to a woman in my life, like friends, lovers, people that have been close enough to share their innermost feelings that they didn't share with me some very upsetting story. I don't know that I have one friend that was free from some kind of, abusive situation from men. There's a revolution in thought happening. And I think it's been interesting to watch. I did this whole play, Coast of Utopia, about mid-19th century Russian radicals and about what it takes for revolution to happen. And it's always seems impossible until one straw happens and then the whole thing goes up in flames. And right now, there is a revolution in thought and things that were acceptable are unacceptable and they should be. Mm-hmm. And it's happening and eggs are breaking. And I live in New York for a reason. I've always been allergic to the business of making movies. I've always been allergic to people that pursue power. I find it unattractive, people who like to have power over other people. My favorite directors all empower people. They make others better, their best self. And I've had so many powerful women in my life influence me. And I've been really grateful. You know, just in the last couple of years, actually, I was directed by Rebecca Miller, who is an amazing young woman. And she directed me different than any male director. Aisling Walsh directed me in Maudie, this movie that a lot of people haven't seen. But Sally Hawkins, you know, got nominated for an Oscar last year for Shape of Water, which she should have been nominated for. But she was equally brilliant in Maudie. And she's one of the best actors I've ever worked with in my life. And the power of her imagination is so intense. And the male world has a lot to learn from these women. You know, I got to work with Greta Gerwig last year, Julianne Moore. There is a revolution of thought that needs to happen for movies and culture to move forward. And you and I could probably talk for a long time about why it happened right now. I think it has a lot to do with a feeling of powerlessness and an anger at the male government and where it's taken us. You know, when we talked about First Reformed, that cry is, you know, our spiritual leaders, our political leaders are really disappointing.
Yeah.
And they need to be torn down.
Well, last question then, and this again comes from my brilliant native Texan producer, Brian. This, I guess in a way it sort of links back to Blaze, the movie that's out now. He points out that in an August interview in Dallas, you said that your 1954 Martin guitar is the only thing you care about in your house other than people.
That is true, yeah. If the place caught on fire, that's the only thing I'd go in for. And it's the only thing, you know, when my son has his friends over, I'm like, where's my guitar? What's happening? I've had the guitar now for a long time, and I love it. And it's part of my, I don't know, you know, my dad took me to my first concert in 1976. I went to go see Willie Nelson's 4th of July picnic. And I don't know, I followed Kris Kristofferson and Waylon and Willie and Merle and, you know, and Dolly Parton and Lucinda Williams. And I followed all of them my whole life with a burning passion. I think probably because my mom was moving all over the East Coast and it was a way to kind of stay connected to my father in Texas, is I would just listen to country music. And I'm a terrible guitar player, but I love to beat out three chord songs. And Blaze Foley and Townes Van Zandt, I've got plenty of three chord songs that have a lot to say about the universe. And making that movie is somehow connected to this whole part of my psyche, you know. Mm-hmm. And I should say that, you know, because you said several times that I wrote the movie, and I did, but I wrote it with Sybil Rosen,
yeah,
who wrote a memoir called Living in the Woods in a Tree, Remembering Blaze Foley. And she is really the spiritual touchstone of the movie. She's the lightning in the bottle. Making this movie, Blaze, is one of the most magical experiences of my life, bar none. There's something crazy about it that I hope is manifest on the screen when you see it. But it was a wildness to it. There was nothing safe about making it. And I still can't believe we did it, but so much of that wildness is her. And her strength. She's also an actor like me and also a writer. And she really gave Ben and Charlie permission to make art. You know, there's this weird shame attached to playing real people that you admire. It's like kind of there's this weird, it happened to me when I played Chet Baker too. It's weird, like I don't want to pose. And Charlie and Ben are very intelligent men and they want to make art. And Sybil is a very intelligent person who knows the difference between reality and art. And she really encouraged all of us to speak to what Blaze means to us, you know, and to use his songs and use Townes' songs to communicate something. So she was such a big part of the making of this movie. And in so many ways, I really feel like it's her movie, that we made it for her and with her. And so I just wanted the opportunity to say that.
Yeah. Well, Ethan Hawke, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, Ethan Hawke's new film is called Blaze, which he directed and co-wrote, and it's based on the life of country musician Blaze Foley. The film opens nationwide on Friday. We've got a copy of the trailer at our website, onpointradio.org. And we're going to go out today with a little more of Blaze Foley's music. This is Our Little Town from the 1989 recording Live at the Austin Outhouse. You can also continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Kyrie Thompson, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Madeline D'Angelo and Lexi Peary. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
With empty arms that long for you, I only hear the lonesome sounds since you left. Since you left, I